Jesus must have been tired. A lot was going on. The Gospel of Matthew records as the story increases in intensity towards the cross. He records these stories. First, the Pharisees and scribes come to Jesus and they say, "Why aren't you doing things the way you've always done them?" And then Jesus is confronted by a Canaanite woman who basically says, "If you are blessing the Jews, aren't you also to bless the entire world?" And Jesus, of course, says, "Yes, of course." And then Jesus tries to get away up to a mountaintop and he's followed by 4,000 people. And these 4,000 people bring to him the blind, the lame, and the mute. And he heals them. It was a busy night filled with activity. And of course, he doesn't want to send them back to their villages just yet because they hadn't eaten. So Jesus feeds them. So you can imagine the busyness of just these couple days. So then Jesus slips away one more time and he invites his disciples to come with him. Now, remember that for the last 2 years, his disciples had been with him wherever he went. They were itinerant, which meant that they went from village to village in Palestine. They camped with each other. They made fires every night and they fished in the lakes for their food. So every night for 2 full years, the disciples talked with Jesus. They discussed all the exciting things that were going on. And then finally, this busy moment is over and Jesus has the disciples come away and it's back to the campfire. And at the campfire, Jesus says, "Who do the people say that I am?" And the disciples, they're used to this conversations with one another. They say, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still some say a prophet, you know, maybe like Jeremiah." And then Jesus does one of those things that Jesus does. He invites this deep reflection and he says, "Yeah, but who do you say that I am?" Maybe you have experienced a moment like this. I like to call these holy moments. Moments in front of a fire. Moments with friends. Moments that you want to push the pause button on life on. Because you know something big is going to happen. Something is being called out of you that you did not know was there. So this question echoes in their ears. "Who do you say that I am?" And then Peter stands up and he says this, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." So as we unveil our third puzzle piece, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Now this is a packed phrase. It's loaded with biblical references. And I kind of like to imagine that even though Peter was the voice of this awesome confession, that this was a community thing. After all, when you are with people by the fireside, and when you've discussed theological things, and you've talked about the Bible, it's all an exchange of ideas where you get better by that person's idea, and then that person's idea builds, and reading the Bible's like that. It's a community thing. It's a thing where we're strengthened by everyone's voice in this awesome conversation. But what does that phrase mean? Let's take it from the last to the front. So first of all, he describes God. This is not this no-name God. This is the living God. A God who's alive and active, dynamic, personal, creative, faithful, and just. The God that we saw working through the pages of Scripture on our first week of our story. A dynamic God on a pursuit to make a people that would transform the world with love. Incredible. A second phrase, the Son of God. Now what's really interesting is that in chapter 14, verse 33, the disciples are out on the lake and Jesus isn't there and he pushes them, just go along, and all of a sudden he's walking on the water. And Peter says, let me walk with you. So Peter walks out in that water and he begins to sink. You all know this story. And then, of course, he says, Lord, save me. But what we don't remember about that story is that all of a sudden the disciples, and in unison with one another, said, you are the Son of God. They had already been talking about what was going on, what God was doing through Jesus with one another. So in this great moment, Peter echoes again what the community had said together. And Son of God was this hope bursting forth through the pages of the Bible that a God would come and would restore the world. A God would come and redeem the world from all the brokenness that we see around us. And then the last phrase, Messiah. This one has to do with imperial claims. King, the anointed one, or God's chosen agent. So in this holy moment, with just his disciples, with Jesus prodding them to say, who do you say that I am? Peter, on behalf of all the disciples there, said, you're the Messiah, the Son of the living God. This is the great confession that the church makes. And it's simply this, that God chose Jesus to make right the wrongs of the world. That God chose us to set the world aright once again. That we are the people of God to transform this world, to heal people, to bind up the brokenhearted, to share love with our community. It's an incredible vision that's planted by that one small saying. Then Jesus says, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this didn't come from flesh and blood. This came from God. Translation, you just had a holy moment that came from God. Good job. And then it goes on to say, remember the holy moment was all about the community. It wouldn't have been a holy moment if it weren't for the brothers and sisters that were there, that were present. Then it goes on and it says this. It says, your name is Rock. Literally, we say Peter, and that has become a proper English word. But literally, think of stone or gravel. And on this stone, I will build my church. Well, what the heck is going on in this passage? And again, we have that puzzledness that makes us say, what could that possibly mean? And let me just tell you, this passage has caused more controversy than most passages in the New Testament. Because over here on this side, you have those who say, the rock is Peter, meaning the historical Peter. And everyone who wants to be a part of the church is sort of in the lineage of Peter. We all are thankful for Peter for this great confession. But then there's ones that are over on this side, and they say, No. You Peter people, this is about Jesus. The church is about Jesus. And the confession is that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of the living God. So the church is built on Jesus, not just on Peter. But I think that the middle is the most healthy in this passage. And actually is really powerful to think about. Because there's no church without the confession of Peter and the confession of Christians throughout the ages. And there's no church without God who acted in Jesus to bring about this incredible restoration project. So the people and the confession and God come together in the middle. So this is about a community confession. What's the church built on? The church is built on the commitment between God and God's people. The church is about covenant. This passage is a covenant passage. A passage that we come together in this holy moment and we commit to God to be the love that He has asked us to be in the world. Just like we learned last week, to be the Sermon on the Mount's incredible vision. Peacemakers, justice seekers, compassionate to those in need, humble, and on and on and on. This amazing vision of love that Jesus offers us. Revolutionary love. Then the verse goes on. And it says something to us that's incredibly important. It says that that rock the church is built on, meaning every one of us, and our confession that Jesus is a king, alive, dynamic, transforming the world, that the gates of hell will not overcome it. The gates of hell is symbolic of every force of evil in our world. That opposition we know all too well. Those diseases that we do not understand why they came to our world. Somehow, ultimately, God promises us that the church, the precious people of God, will not be overcome by these forces that seek to drag us down. Incredible. Then the verse goes on and it says this: whatever you bind in heaven is bound, and whatever you loose in heaven is loose. Because the keys, literally the keys of the kingdom, are given to you. Again, you should definitely be scratching your head and saying, what is that verse talking about? And again, it's very interesting because rabbis in ancient Israel, they talked a lot about binding and loosing. And what it meant is that every generation, every one of us in this place and in this time has the holy responsibility to interpret this 66 book, huge book that God gifts us with. So the Bible never interprets itself. We are faced with different historical questions and in different historical moments, and we must grapple and wrestle with the Bible and actually with one another say, yeah, this is the direction that we should take for Christian life. And that's an amazing process. And that's not a monolithic process. That comes where we all share our voices, where we all add our piece in, and where we deeply wrestle and discern, and we say, yeah, this is what kingdom people should look like. This is what people who say, God is the King. God is the Son of the living God. So then we come to this question, How do we read the Bible in such a way that actually the fabric of who we are is transformed? And I suggest to you today that what we need is to develop scriptural imagination. Just like an athlete develops his muscles, we need to develop the scriptural imagination within our beings. It's a mind, a heart, and a bodily thing that we do. And why we do this? So that we can answer the question, what's God doing in our community? How can we be a part of this awesome God's reign of love in Rifle, Colorado? So as we develop the scriptural imagination, we need to do a couple of things. And first, we attend church. And we immerse ourselves in bath. Bath is baptism. Now, many of you have seen probably hundreds of babies baptized right here in this place. But remember that baptism, it's not just about the child and the child's family. Baptism is about every one of us reaffirming, recommitting again that we have died to that former life and that we are accepting a kingdom life, that we are being renewed daily to live the reign of God through baptism. We develop a scriptural imagination through the book, through high quality preaching that's thoughtful and that's creative. And you know that I care about this. Preaching that doesn't condemn but elicits conversations everywhere. That's when you know that preaching is at its best. When we are communicating with one another and saying, what the heck did Pastor Dale say? That is healthy and a good thing. I am overjoyed by the emails and Facebook posts I get when someone said, man, you should have seen the conversation we had at lunch after church because of what you said. I'm like, yes, I did my job. That makes me joyful. So, and then we develop a scriptural imagination by table. Every month at our church, we break the bread and we share the cup. And why do we do that? We do that, again, to reenact or to remind ourselves of the story of Jesus. this courageous example of someone who transformed the world, to find forgiveness, but to also commit ourselves to those kingdom virtues. And then, of course, time. This is the one that really hit me this week. In the church, we celebrate these different seasons. We celebrate Advent, where we have that beautiful tree here, and we talked about the coming of the baby Jesus. We celebrate Epiphany. We celebrate Lent, which Lent is sort of like the preseason of the whole Christian life, where we reroot ourselves in our disciplines and in our love for others. We celebrate Easter with great celebration and wonderful music. And we celebrate Pentecost, the birth of the church. And the genius of this cycle is that it trains our bodies to have a scriptural imagination, that inside of us there's this impulse to do right when we are training ourselves in the right world. There's a way of seeing the world that comes from this type of rooting ourselves in, that we can say, yeah, we can show love. We can think about things through Christ's point of view. We can discern what God's doing, and we can become a part of it. But then we also do some other things. We learn to pray together. Prayer is hard work, if you've ever tried it. We learn that with one another in community. We study together. We study books, we study the Bible, and we learn to not only ask deep questions of God, why is this so? What does this mean? We also are ourselves asked questions. Who do you say that I am? And then we sing together. And you want to know the world's best secret? In your hymn books and on these screens, hymns are filled with Scripture. Christian songs are filled with Scripture. And they're meant not just to entertain us, but to develop the scriptural imagination within our being. And then, of course, and this one's important, we rest. Without resting, we can never have those holy moments with God. Without taking time for ourselves, I don't know how many times people say this to me. Oh, I'm just so sorry. I had to miss today because I had to go camping. I can't say it any stronger. To go camping with your family, to go fishing in this beautiful place that we live in, that's a holy moment. Just don't do it every week. But that is a holy thing that happens. And rest is defined this way by God over and over again in the Bible. Do what fills your soul up. Some like to read, some fish, some snowshoe, some snowmobile. Whatever fills your soul is what God asks you to do. Whatever allows time and room for holy moments. And then we serve. Because just if scriptural imagination is just about our head and our hearts, we're missing it. It needs to get into our legs, into our bodies. It's bodily. So we serve. And many of us serve at the hospital here. And many of us serve at Meals and Wheels. And even someone in our congregation is caring enough about babies in our community to this week actually put on a little seminar on how to put your car seats in correctly. Because parents don't have this knowledge. That's what it means to be kingdom people. Many of us serve also at Lift Up, and we do so many things. But unless we get this out into the world, our scriptural imagination will be malformed within us. So then we basically come to this point where at the very end of this story, the very next story, there's another story to tell you, by the way. And at the very end of this next story, Peter, he takes Jesus aside, and notice he's alone, apart from the community. And he says, hey, Jesus, you're not really serious about this suffering and dying thing? And then Jesus says, get behind me. Not because Jesus is mad or angry, but because Jesus is filled with scriptural imagination. And he knows he has to take his battle to the temple and to die to show us the greatest of love of all. So on our own, we learn from Peter, on our own, we can really miss the point. On our own, we can't develop the scriptural imagination that God is calling us to develop within us. It's like this. There's some in our world that think, I can do it on my own. They clench their fist, they bite their lip, And I must confess to you that some days I struggle with this. But what Jesus calls us to is to unloosen the grip that our hands have on ourself, to open our arms and hold one another's hands and learn to lean on one another and learn to learn from one another and learn to be in community with our brothers and sisters as we seek to change the world. And in this, we have the awesome responsibility of becoming the people of God. People who are courageous. People like you.